Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater, and your moderator for this morning. Today is Sunday, August 9, 2026. This year ID numbers for Friday, August 7th are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,705, that's 23705. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,706, that's 23706. This morning, A Vision for You presents Releasing Our Grip. The way we manage our own lives and attempt to manage others' lives as well, brings us to the end of our rope. We hit bottom. Our ways and our efforts have failed us. Certainly, we are the architects of our own misery. Life rarely unfolds according to our wishes, our demands, and our expectations. Yet many of us move through it with our minds and fists tightly clenched, determined to control and to force a particular outcome. We become attached to how events should happen and who people should be. The tighter we grip relationships, careers, places, possessions, our dreams, things, the more exhausting life becomes. We suffer until we have suffered enough to be willing to surrender and look for something better. What is that something better? Well, the Big Book tells us. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. We could no longer insist on having our own way, on trying to control other people, on believing that we always know what's best for ourselves, the world, and everyone else. The 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book represent a process resulting in a spiritual awakening, a deep and lasting personal transformation. The actual solution to releasing our clenched fist comes not from getting exactly what we wanted, but finding and establishing a relationship with power with whom we can connect and align. We begin to be able to respond to life rather than react to it. Recovery allows us to loosen the grip of our minds and unclench our fists for a whole new way of life, a new freedom, and a new happiness. Joining us today to elaborate on this topic is Chris G., a recovered compulsive overeater from Alabama. Chris is devoted to our 12-step way of life and to carrying the message of recovery, and it's with great appreciation that I welcome Chris G. to the line. Good morning, Chris. Star one to unmute, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me, Leah. Can I be heard?
Yes, Chris.
Okay, thank you so much. What a fabulous introduction, Leah. You hit on all the points that I'm going to elaborate on this morning. I'm really grateful for A Vision for You for asking me to be your speaker this morning. I'm very honored and very blessed to be a part of this amazing fellowship, and most importantly, this fabulous way of life that I've learned through working the 12 steps of OA. I do have a new freedom and a new happiness today that I am so grateful for. So my talk today is, the title is Releasing Our Grip, and one of the things that I want to do right now before we get started is to release my grip on how I think this talk is going to turn out, and the outcomes of it, that I pray that everything that I say here in this talk this morning is exactly what you all need to hear. And I let go of how I'm going to say it, when I'm going to say it, if I'm going to say everything that I thought I was going to say, you know, how our mind gets all crazy. I'm going to take a moment to pause and actually release my own grip, which means I'm pausing to soften my body and to soften my hands and soften my face. And I ask God for quiet and to find some stillness so that I can be of maximum benefit to you, so that I can be a channel for the wisdom and the hope that needs to be expressed here today. God, please set aside for me everything I think I know about you, me, AA, OA, the 12 steps, recovery, and especially spiritual matters, and especially this special edition talk, so that I may have an open mind for a new experience of all of these things. And God, please help me see and speak the truth. And so it is. So, powerlessness. That's really the problem. When I first came in to OA, I thought food was the problem. I really thought that food was the problem. But in my years of compulsive overeating and my years of recovery, I've learned that food was actually what I was trying to use as the solution to my problem. This was a huge realization for me. I'm just going to briefly qualify, because it's important for you all to know that I really can kind of claim my seat here. I was born into an alcoholic family with a father who was drinking and a mother who was compulsively overeating. So I wasn't really taught the tools on how to really successfully deal with life. I wasn't taught healthy coping. I was taught really unhealthy coping. I really did use food as my solution to life early on. And I remember as a young child, you know, having two bowls of cereal and not one. I remember coming home from school and I just couldn't wait to just be home alone with the food. I recognized that there were things that I was doing with food that were not normal. I would hide and sneak food. I would do things with food that, you know, other people were not doing. I was doing things with food that led me to having physical difficulties, like eating so much frozen yogurt that I would actually give myself diarrhea. I would graze all day long. I actually used food as my response to any feeling I had. I used food for anxiety. When I was in college, I would just sit at the table doing my homework and cramming for exams, and I would just have this, you know, giant bag of whatever it was that I would just be constantly. It was like I was like a constant snacker. In fact, when I was in high school, I remember a kid came up to me and he said, "You're always eating." And I was like, oh, my God. I didn't even realize anybody was noticing that. But in a way, I wasn't even noticing it. You know, I was just trying to survive my life. And then it gets pointed out to me that, wow, this is not normal. For years, I tried to control and manage it. I tried to diet, restrict, starve. I would overeat and then I would overexercise. I used food for fun, for boredom, for companionship when I was lonely. I used it as my lover. I used it to celebrate. I used it when I was sad. And I really used it when I was angry. So I used food as the solution to my life. The problem is that I wasn't really practicing a healthy life. I wasn't using healthy coping skills. I didn't know healthy coping skills, which is why I'm so grateful that I found the 12 steps of OA, because it's taught me healthy coping and actually how to deal with my anger. You know, we have four-step inventory that we get to do, and we get precise instructions on what to do and how to do it. And we have sponsors in this program who help light the path and show the way and give us support and love and feedback and direction. This program really does work. It is a design for living that is a practice. It's a daily practice to live this way. And by being taken through the 12 steps with a recovered compulsive overeater who's been through it, that's how we learn actually how to work these steps so that we can really use it in our day-to-day life. I felt like I was really in the boxing ring with the food. You know, it started out like when I was younger, it was like I was kind of like in the ballroom with food. You know, I was like dancing with the food. I was exhilarated. I was, you know, exhilarated and in love with it. I was infatuated with it. I was enamored with it. I mean, I really loved my food. It was like that was my primary relationship, was with food. Like, I did not have a spiritual life as a child. It was just me and the food. I was addicted, but I didn't know it. I didn't know that I couldn't stop. I mean, because I've spent the first like 30 years trying to stop on my own will, trying to control and manage it. I mean, I was using food as a performance drug, as a way to get high. I used it to survive. It was my escape. It was my entertainment. It was my temporary solution to anxiety. Any feeling I didn't want to feel, I just ate. And I practiced it. I mean, I got really good at it. Whatever we practice, we get good at, right? So when I ate certain foods, I had to eat it till it was gone. I didn't have a choice. I mean, that is really powerlessness. When once you start, you can't stop. Even when you want to, you can't stop. That's really what our powerlessness is, that we're powerless over especially certain foods. Right? Certain foods are like alcoholic to my body. Once I put them in me, I had to have more. There are a lot of foods where I had very little control over the amount I took, even if I thought I was, oh, I was only going to have, you know, one bowl of this. Inevitably, I'd go back and get more. Since I didn't have a way of life that actually worked, I didn't have the tools. I'm actually kind of grateful that at least I had the food to survive my life back then. But now I know that I'm so glad I've grown through the 12 steps and I don't have to do that anymore. As a kid, I was not modeled healthy conflict resolution or communication. I didn't know how to be honest with how I felt. I was not honored for who I was. I was shamed. I was regularly shamed by my family. I was shamed for being fat. I was shamed for being emotional. My family would always say, oh, Chris, you're just overreacting. You know, I'm a highly emotional, highly sensitive artist type, and I have big emotions. And I was just shamed for being expressive as a child. I was ashamed for not being perfect. I was ashamed and I looked at myself as, you know, I'm not good enough. And, if I could only be perfect, then I would be loved. I just desperately wanted to be loved. And so I put all of my energy into showing up as being as perfect as I could be. You know, then I would get the praise, you know, and when I got the praise, you know, I would feel loved. But what happened is I grew up to be an inauthentic overachiever and people pleaser, just desperately wanting your attention and your love. My thinking early on was I just have to be the best. I have to be amazing. You know, then I'll be loved. I also had to not be a problem. Since my father was an alcoholic, there was a lot of dysfunction in my family, and there was a lot of hiding. You know, my mom didn't want anybody to know. My father ended up drinking himself to death, and I lost him when I was only 23 years old. I was in my last year of college at UCSD, and I lost my dad. That semester, I got like a 4.0 in my grade point average, because what do? I need to be perfect. I need to be perfect. I need to not be a problem, you know? And all the while, I was using food to numb my pain. My lowest weight was about 150 to 155 pounds. I'm almost 6 feet tall, so that is very, very underweight for me. My top weight is 243 pounds. So today, I'm about 100, ranging around 165 to 170 pounds, which is what my doctor recommends, is that's a healthy body weight for me. And I've been in the same size jeans for the last 2 years, have not had to buy another pair of jeans. In fact, I got rid of all the sizes that don't fit. You know, when I was in my disease, I never got rid of any clothes. I mean, I had a size 10 to a size 18, and I never knew where I was going to be. I never had faith that I was going to be at a healthy body weight. There was always the, oh, I'm going to restrict and then get down to a low body weight. And then, of course, I'm scared of binging, and I would gain. I gained 30 pounds in my first year of college. So I know this disease really well. This disease had me by the neck. You know, it went from dancing in the ballroom with the food, you know, as a love affair, to like being in the boxing ring with a gorilla. And, you know, when you're in the ring with the gorilla, it's the gorilla decides when you're done. And I was powerless. I was trying to control and manage. And I ended up at about 30 years old, walking into the rooms of OA with this experience that I was really eating against my own will, that I really wanted to stop eating. I wanted to find how do I stop? I want to stop, but I cannot stop. That's the definition of addiction, wanting to stop but not being able to. I was addicted to food. I was using compulsive food behaviors, like chewing an entire pack of gum in 45 minutes. You know, one after the other, after the other. That's a compulsive food behavior for me. I needed to let go of gum. I was a grazer. I really needed to allow for a healthy food plan, not a restrictive food plan, but a healthy food plan that would allow me to arrive at a healthy body weight. You know, abstinence is refraining from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors while working toward or maintaining a healthy body weight. I needed to be on a food plan where I was working toward a healthy body weight. The other thing is, I needed to get really aware of what foods I needed to release my grip on, because there were some foods that would trigger the compulsive overeating for me, like an allergy of the body. Like, that's an abnormal reaction to certain foods. There are some foods that once I start in, I can't stop. I'm not going to have any relief unless I have entire abstinence from those foods. There is no, you know, me moderating a dessert for me. I know some people don't have a problem with that, but I do. I can't have just, you know, half a cookie. That's impossible. I would never have like a half an ice cream cone and then just throw the rest in the trash like normal people do. That would never happen. So I had to get really honest with what foods am I gripping so tightly to that I'm addicted to, that I feel like I can't live without. That required a lot of honesty for me. And you know, I came in 2006. So I've been at this recovery journey, practicing the steps, practicing recovery, for the last 20 years. I have not been abstaining for 20 years. I have a special edition on file from March 23rd of 2025 called Many Surrenders to Massive Freedom, and it kind of details out all those years of recovery, the first 17, 18 years, my whole journey and all the different surrenders. So I'm not going to go into all of that today because my talk is about releasing my grip. And I want to tell you guys a bunch of stories from the last year and a half that have really that really showcase exactly how this design for living actually works when we really release our grip. But the very first thing that we need to get honest about is our grip on the food. What I've realized is that once I release my grip on the food lets go of me. But I have to let go first. I have to have that key of willingness where I'm willing to be separated from the food. It's not that I put the food down. That's not really what it's like. What it's like is, God, I am powerless over this food, and I am sincerely asking for separation from it. Please separate me from the foods that I'm using, that I'm harming myself with. Please give me peace. Please help me follow my food plan. Please help me eat, you know, moderate, healthy meals at regular times. And please keep me separated from the foods that are not helpful for me. It's a prayer. It's a willingness to be separated. It's not a muscling. It's not about, you know, trying harder to control the food. That's not like that at all. It's a surrender. It's a release. It's we have to release our grip. And we have to begin to trust. This whole process of coming in contact with our higher power is actually the result of working the steps. Having had a spiritual experience as the result of the steps. So we get to work these steps as a design for living over and over and over again. Practicing the 12 steps is, it's not like we do them and we're done and then we like go skipping along. It's like being an NBA player, you know, where you got to practice shooting those baskets tens of thousands of times, hundreds of thousands of times, shooting the baskets. Eventually, you know, you'll be able to make a three-pointer, no problem. And that's kind of what spiritual practice is for me. I'm shooting the baskets with God, and I'm practicing every day. And the more we practice anything, the better we get. Prayer and meditation, that's a practice. Prayer and meditation is really not for that time that you're actually praying and meditating for the 30 minutes in the morning. It's a practice so that when at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, your kid comes home from school and they're totally dysregulated and they say they hate you and, you know, you're totally dysregulated and it's all chaotic, that's when we need to have the practice of our prayer and meditation to kick in. That's when hopefully we have enough conscious contact with God and enough presence to be able to notice that we're dysregulated, that we're disturbed and agitated. That's when we have to pause. For me, noticing when I need to pause and then actually pausing, actually coming into my breath, taking some space. Sometimes I need to actually tell my daughter, you know, I'm not in the best space to have a conversation with you right now, so I'm going to take some space and I'm going to calm down and I'm going to revisit this and we can talk about this later. And I go take space. Sometimes I'm so dysregulated that I have to get in the shower and take an extremely cold shower or an extremely hot shower to reset my body. Sometimes I even go and do a cold plunge at a place near my house because I need help in regulating. But what I know I can do in any given moment is pause. And in the AA 12 and 12 in chapter 3, at the very end of chapter 3, there's a paragraph that says, in all times of emotional disturbance or indecision, we pause, we ask for quiet, and in the stillness, we do the serenity prayer. God, help me accept what I cannot change about this situation. Grant me the serenity to accept what I cannot change. My daughter, my family, what they say, what they believe, how they are, how they treat me, my life, the people in my life, what they choose to do. Grant me the serenity to accept everything that I cannot change, and grant me the courage to change what I can change. What can I change? I can change how often I connect to my higher power. I can change how tightly I'm gripping my hands, my teeth clenched, my face squished. I can change that. I can stop and pause and be still. I can soften my face. I can relax my shoulders down. I can release my grip. I can open my hands. I can receive guidance and intuition and love from my higher power. I can take space away from toxic situations. I can make a phone call. I can use the tools of the program. I can write in my journal, which is where I do all my 10 steps. I have a 10-step journal that's like one of those $5 cheap throwaway journals from Five Below, you know, the ones that are like really cheap but that are really thick. And I just write and write and write. I do all my writing in there. And then at the end, I just throw it in the trash. Because God forbid anybody sees that shit. I mean, that's, I'm raw. I'm really raw. But I need to process and get all that stuff out. Journaling is an amazing tool for me to become regulated, to connect with God. And there's so much pausing that happens in that. So much releasing my grip on everything I'm trying to control there. So for me, I am just so incredibly grateful for having the willingness to release the foods and the compulsive food behaviors that were killing me. I had to want to stop. I mean, this program really doesn't work unless you really want to stop. If there are foods that, you know, that we're eating that we really don't want to stop eating, it's not going to happen. It requires willingness to be separated. You know, we have to be willing to let go first. And then miraculously, the food lets go of us. I have no idea how this happens. All I know is that it does happen. And I'm just grateful because I know I'm not struggling against the food anymore. It, you know, in the beginning it might feel like white knuckling, but we have to become sufficiently connected with power, right? Because, you know, the problem is powerlessness. So if the problem is that we're powerless, the solution has to be power. The solution's not food. That's just we're believing a lie, right? The disease is just a liar, just lies to us, thinking that, oh, the food will fix it. No, no, no. The food never fixed anything for me. Nothing more than like a temporary numbing and soothing. It always caused a lot more problems for me. So the solution is power. And how do we get in touch with this power? We work the steps and we really practice pausing and connecting with a higher power. We have to have a relationship with power. And then we have to have a right relationship with food. You know, it's different with alcohol because with alcohol, it's like you can just sever the relationship entirely, right? I mean, you don't have to, you know, have alcohol to exist. Well, we have to eat. We don't have to eat our alcoholic foods. We can have complete separation from our alcoholic foods. There's tons of healthy, neutral foods that we can eat. So the process of working the steps and working with a sponsor is I learned I needed to have a right relationship with food. And I never knew what that was like. I mean, my best thinking was to, skip breakfast, have a granola bar for lunch, and, graze all afternoon and binge. That was my best thinking back in the disease. Binge, restrict, control, starve, overexercise, crazy, insane. I had to really see my insanity. So right relationship with food for me today means I follow a food plan from a nutritionist. I actually weigh and measure most of my meals because it's peaceful. I like knowing that I'm properly nourished. It's not about restricting at all. It's about how do I give my body the healthiest food in the most appropriate amounts so that I can be of maximum benefit to the planet. I actually want to do that today. I heard in program once, you have to do this until you want to do this. Like how long do I have to go to meetings? Well, you have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. How long do I have to weigh and measure my food? Well, you have to weigh and measure your food until you want to, until you actually want to eat healthy, moderate meals. Today, I don't need to weigh and measure every little thing that goes into my mouth because I have a relationship with power where I'm actually eating moderate, healthy meals now because I've practiced so much that now it's just what I do. It's like a gift. It's like a blessing. I don't even know. It's miraculous because being the compulsive overeater I was, grazing all day long, it's amazing that I have my breakfast and I don't even think about food till lunch. And then I have a healthy lunch. It's like, what? How is that even happening? It says in the book, we've ceased fighting everything or anyone, even the food, because sanity has returned. Sanity. Freedom. That's the result of working these steps. And it is real and it is amazing and it is not to be missed. And, one of the things I remembered early on in program, the long timers that I was sitting next to in Los Angeles, they would just say, keep coming back. Keep coming back. This is a journey. This is a long journey. And I am so glad I'm here. I'm so fortunate I found the 12 steps as a way of life. So releasing my grip on the food was the first thing I needed to do. But then came releasing my grip on perfectionism. So because I grew up being an overachiever, perfectionist, captain of the volleyball team, president of all the clubs, just wanting to be loved, wanting to be prove myself, wanting to be appreciated, because deep down inside, I didn't feel like I was loved. I didn't feel good enough. That's why I was doing all that stuff. In my recovery, I was stuck trying to be perfect with the food. In my early recovery, I remember I was about to take my 6-month chip, and I didn't take it because I was comparing myself to everyone else and what they were doing and what they were abstaining from. And I feel like, well, I'm not doing it exactly like them, but I'm not overeating like I was, but I'm not, abstaining from the things they're abstaining from. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know the difference between abstinence and food plan. And so I shared with a long timer, I don't feel like my recovery is good enough to take my 6-month chip. And, she was so kind and honest with me. She said, well, have you been overeating like you were when you were in the disease? I said, no, I haven't. I'm trying to do my 3 meals a day and I'm working the steps with a sponsor and I'm in the middle of my 4th step. And she's like, Chris, keep moving forward. Just keep moving. She goes, take your 6-month chip and just keep moving forward. And I said, okay, I'm going to take direction. And I am so glad I did. Because if I spent that whole time thinking that I had to be perfect in order to recover, I would never recover. Recovery is not about perfectionism. It's about alignment. There's a difference. It's about being in alignment with love and with God whatever your conception of God is, the beauty of the 12 steps is that we get to choose our own conception of God. The great reality is deep within us. You know, I never really had a relationship with a higher power growing up. We were not religious people. I didn't know anything about God. I was confused about the word God. To me, the source with a capital S feels most resonant to me when I talk about my higher power. It could be the creative intelligence of the universe. It could be the great reality within us, the spirit of the universe, infinite love, higher power, God, the mystery. I mean, any conception will do. So in my disease, you know, I really felt like no one would love me if they ever knew the truth, you know, especially that I was a compulsive overeater. Like, I never wanted people to see that. But in OA, I really had to admit that I was a compulsive overeater. It took me a long time before I could even get comfortable saying I was a compulsive overeater in the meetings. One of the things that happened that was very powerful for me is once I took that six-month chip, and I went home to my boyfriend, and I were hanging out that evening after the meeting. And he was in recovery 21 years in another program. And he thought I was going to Al-Anon because I was lying to him because I didn't want him to know I was a compulsive overeater. And he's like, "Hey, how was your meeting?" And I said, "Oh, my God. It was amazing. It was so great. I took my six-month chip. I was so proud, you know, that I just did that. It was like I was relieved." And he said to me, he goes, "You took your six-month chip? They give chips in Al-Anon? Oh, my God." I had to sit down and I had to tell him the truth. I had to tell him that I was a compulsive overeater. I was so scared that he was going to run, but I was so scared that if he found out I was a compulsive overeater, that he wouldn't love me, that he would want to break up with me. But I knew I had to tell the truth because I got caught. You know, I got caught in the lie. And that night was the first night he actually said he loved me. I was so blown away. I'm like, wait a second. I thought that if anyone knew I was a compulsive overeater, that I was somehow defective, that no one would love me, no one would want to be with me if they knew, you know, that I was a compulsive overeater and what I did with food. But here's this beautiful, gentle, amazing man in recovery who just found out that I was a compulsive overeater and took six months. And he's telling me he loves me. Now that is the truth, that we are loved in all of our imperfection, with everything, as messy and crazy as we are, you know, with all kinds of, you know, addictions and weird habits and compulsive behaviors. It's a lie to think we're not loved in all of that. Being sufficiently connected with power means that we can actually start feeling love amidst all of the imperfection. To release my grip on the perfectionism is allowing love in. It's really amazing to relax. You know, in the big book it says we relax and take it easy. We do not struggle. It really is about releasing our grip on everything that we're attached to, thinking that that's the answer. The solution is in a relationship with love, a relationship with God, a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. That's the solution. The solution is not trying to control the food, trying to control my teenage kids, trying to control, you know, my husband and my other people. It's like, no. The solution is actually and aligning with love, you know, letting go of that perfectionism in exchange for alignment. You know, I don't feel like my food is perfect, but it's aligned with God. It's a healthy meal. It doesn't have my alcoholic ingredients in it. It's all good. It's a softening, it's a relaxing, it's a trusting, like capital T trust. But this is all a result of working the steps. Years and years of working the steps over and over, lots of different sponsors. I think I've had about 7 or 8 different sponsors, and I have 2 now. I have one sponsor that I work with who's about 38 years in program in Los Angeles, one of the original ladies in my original home group. And we read the OA and AA literature together twice a week. We're still reading the book together. And then I have another sponsor who is like my emotional sobriety sponsor. This is the one I, you know, commit my food to and talk about my crazy disease thinking that afflicts me sometimes, where I'm totally powerless over my thinking and we process stuff. And both of my sponsors, I talk completely honestly with. I have to have a sponsor that I feel safe with, that I feel is not judging me, that is not going to harm me in any way. So I'm a very sensitive person, so I need those, you know, lovey, ooey, gooey, swishy, squishy kind of sponsors, you know, like that's what works best for me. I love the wisdom that my sponsors have for me. They're both older than me and have more time in recovery than me, and I think that's important. So releasing my grip on the food, and that's not something you do once either, by the way. If ever I notice a food gripping on me, I know that time to take a look at that. I recently released my grip on coffee. I was just drinking coffee a little too much, and I really kind of wanted it too much. I'm like, you know, I don't really like the way coffee has a grip on me. I'm gonna allow God to take that. And for me, it's not like I'll never have a cup of coffee, but I just am more aware that I'm actually in a better place when I don't have it. So there's this ease to it. It's just softer and gentler and releasing my grip. You know, when I let go of something, it lets go of me, but I have to let go first. So releasing my grip on my perfectionism, embracing my imperfection and my messiness sometimes. That's been a huge gift of the program, because that was one of my main character defects, perfectionism, and also being critical and judgmental. I've had to release my grip on that. But the next thing I want to talk about is releasing my grip on my future. When I was about 5 years in recovery, my boyfriend, who I really wanted to be with for the rest of my life, told me he didn't want to get married and he didn't want to have kids. And that was always a dream of mine. I had to release my grip on the idea of that, you know, getting married and having kids was where my happiness was. I really needed to practice the serenity prayer here and be like, okay, I can't change the fact that he doesn't want this. And I had to have a lot of pausing, a lot of connecting with God about this. I needed to accept him and his beliefs. I've had to release my grip so many times, practice not being okay with not getting my way. In fact, what I have learned is I have to get out of the way. It's not about getting my way. It's about getting out of the way, to release my grip, to not hold on so tightly to what I think I want or what I think I need, or, you know, being married, having kids. I really needed to stop forcing, manipulating, and insisting. I never gave him an ultimatum. I just said that it's something that I wanted, but that I loved him. And he actually... This was really amazing, and I think this is in my other special edition, but he proposed out of the blue. We had never really talked about marriage before. All I knew is that he didn't want to do it. But because I was in program and working the 12 steps, I wasn't trying to force and control and manipulate him into doing what I wanted. When he actually proposed, he did it because he wanted to, not because I forced him. And the same thing happened with the kids. He didn't want kids. I married him knowing he didn't want kids. I had to let go and release my grip of ever being a mom. It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. And then a year into being married, it's kind of a long story, but I was going to go on a long-term birth control kind of solution so that we wouldn't have to worry about that. And he's like, you know, I think I want to have kids. I was just floored because I had totally let go of that. Really, I did. I mean, I wrote letters to my unborn kids, you know, saying goodbye. I bought them flowers. I mean, I really processed it. But this is how, you know, the 12-step way of life works, is that we accept the things we cannot change. And we really pause long enough to feel some love. Where is the love? My love was with him the whole time. I loved him enough to let go of what I wanted in exchange for just being okay with what I had. Because it's not about getting everything that we want. It's actually wanting what we have. I think there's a Sheryl Crow song that talks about that. And Bob Dylan and so many artists have written about this. It's really about being present right here, right now. Being grateful for what we do have. If you have love in your life right now, that's what we get to be grateful for. Not some future state. Oh, if only this happens, then I'll be happy. If only that happens, then I'll be happy. What about just practicing being happy in this moment? Happy to be on this call, listening to this lady go all over the place with releasing the grip. Just be here right now. You know, this is where God is. God for me is in the present moment. If I'm caught up in reminiscing about the past or obsessing about the future, I'm in thinking. I'm in my brain. I'm in my thoughts. But when I'm right here, right now, breathing my breath, feeling my body, feeling my face, all the muscles in my face relaxing, opening my hands, releasing my grip, feeling my heart beating inside my body, taking a deep breath right here. This is my experience of love and source and trust and the magic of being alive, being aware and awake and being present to the presence of God right here and now. That's where it always is. And that's where it's always going to be. It's not in the past. It's not in the future. It's right here. So this gratitude and this appreciation for right now, whenever I am dysregulated, I'm usually dysregulated because I have something just happened or I'm afraid something's going to happen. And I need to take the time to pause, to get back to the here and now, to get back into my body and to really look at what's really going on. Because in the past, I would just get dysregulated and I would find myself in the pantry or opening up the freezer, pushing the reality of my situation out. But the opposite is actually true. When we are abstaining from using food as a solution and we instead pause and go within and go deep within to that great reality within us, that's where we find that power greater than ourselves, that love, that embrace, that gentleness, the forgiveness, the compassion. These are all present moment feelings and experiences. So So I had to release my grip on my future also when my husband decided that he wanted to move to Alabama. And that's why I'm in Alabama right now, because I had to let go of my future, of the fact that I thought I was going to live in California my whole life. I spent 50 years in California, all my friends, my relationship, all my clients, my job, everything that I knew, my home, everything. And now I'm in Alabama with my family. My husband has a good job here, and I'm recreating my business, and I'm recreating my art community. I'm recreating my spiritual community. I had to completely release my grip on California in exchange for a new experience. Like, you know, I wondered, why the heck did God, you know, kind of like pluck me out of California and plopped me down in Alabama? You know, within the first 5 months of being here in Alabama, I was able to find five local sponsees to sponsor. And they started recovering. And I knew, I'm like, you know, God, I don't know why you have me in Alabama, but I do know that it's amazing that I've been able to help these women in recovery. And they helped me. Because in carrying the message to them when I got here to Alabama, they kept me well. They kept me in the steps. I mean, I was doing Zoom calls every day, sometimes twice a day, helping them. It was really hard for me that first year in Alabama. I had a lot of feelings. And my sponsor that I was working with for about 2 years had to let go of me as a sponsee because she had some work to do in another facet of the program. And I had to just be okay with that. You know, losing a sponsor is not easy. It's one thing when, you know, you decide a sponsor is not, you know, really working out for you, but then to have a sponsor that you totally love need to, you know, do something different. I knew it wasn't about me, but still I felt very unmoored. So I looked into getting additional help, additional sponsors. And for a while I had three because I just knew I needed to have a sponsor no matter what. And, you know, I kept recovering through this. Releasing my grip, you know, a lot of it is the physical grip, you know, like I described. You know, if your hands are clenched and your face is tight and your shoulders are up to your ears, whenever we notice that our body is gripping, it's a mindfulness practice to pause and to release and relax. And for me, I've had to do a lot of yoga and other physical work to help with that. But it's definitely a practice that I've been getting better at. It's kind of like the physical, emotional, and spiritual releasing the grip. It's the whole, it's all facets of that. I have not been keeping track of the time, but I wanted to tell you one more story. So I had to release the grip on my kids. I've been trying to control and manage my kids ever since they were born, you know. And I got into a problem with one of my daughters. What happened was I was really scared of what her cell phone, her connection with her cell phone and what it was doing. There was a lot of things online that were really scaring the shit out of me about how, you know, social media is causing kids to, you know, commit suicide. And I was just like really, really scared. And I was trying to control her and her, the use of her phone. And she wanted to get an iPhone. And I, at first I'm like, okay. And then I pulled the plug on it at the last minute. My husband and my daughter were like, what? And I said, nope, we can't do this. And I just yanked the whole thing out and she didn't get that. And for like 2 or 3 weeks, she was telling me she hated me every single day. And she wasn't talking to me. She stopped eating. She was going totally emo, goth, you know, with her eye makeup. And she was going to school and her teachers were concerned. And it was a bottom. It was I was trying to control her, and she was revolting against me. I needed to release my grip on my daughter and her wants, her trajectory in life. I actually needed to seek some outside help because I felt like I was really losing. I didn't know if I was going to make it because I really needed my daughter to love me. It was so painful to hear those words coming from her mouth. I thought, I can't live like this. I can't live in a house with someone hating me. I just can't. You know, I realized, because I do a nightly 10-step review, I realized certain things I was doing, you know. I was trying to control them. You know, I wanted them to be different. I wanted them to be nice to me. So I was yelling at them. I was getting angry. I'm trying to control. I'm totally in bondage to self, because what I want them to be smart, articulate, trustworthy. I want them to be honest and decent people who are kind to me, loving and kind to the planet. I want them to be respectful human beings. And when they're not, I'm feeling like I'm failing as a parent, you know? You know, I want them to, you know, clean their room when I want them to. And, you know, I want them to eat apples and not donuts. And I want them to reflect good on me. All that selfishness came out in my 10 steps at night. So much selfishness, so much trying to control. I found myself, I was struggling, I was fighting. Well, in the book, it says we cease fighting. I knew I needed to pause and release my grip on my kids. You know, my daughter, when she got to Alabama, she's like, Mom, I just want to be in regular classes with regular kids. And she was in all honors and advanced classes in California. I had to release my grip on that. That was so hard to just let her be a regular kid in regular classes with the G-pop, you know, the general population of Alabama. So I really had to release my grip on trying to control that and forcing and insisting that she do it my way. So she took a whole year of regular classes. And at the end of that year, she's like, Mom, I need homework. I need to be challenged. And so this year she's going to be taking 2 advanced classes. It's weird how releasing your grip allows for what is supposed to happen to happen. Letting go of control and releasing our grip on our family members and what we want them to do and how we want them to do it, it allows them to come to their own truth about what they need. Because it's not about what I want for them. It's about what they want for them. When that came from her, when she intuitively figured out that, wow, you know, the classes aren't hard enough for her, they're not challenging enough, what a great realization for her to have. So there's a beauty in letting go and letting people be and letting people find their truth. Another thing that happened recently was I got scheduled for a TV interview with my artwork. I'm an artist, and I'm having a show coming up. And the local TV station was doing a community segment, and they wanted to showcase the show. So I was getting kind of nervous about it. And recently, my daughter had been very critical and judgmental of me. You know how 13-year-olds are. They're just like, you know, criticizing and everything that I say or do, every my looks, my everything just gets criticized. She's trying to separate herself from me, and I understand that. But when it came time to do this interview, I was originally thinking that I wanted her to join me to help me with my hair and makeup, maybe, because she's really talented at that, and to have some companionship and support. But because she wasn't being very kind and I was feeling very vulnerable about and nervous about this interview, I told her that I really wanted her support at the interview, but that I noticed that because of the criticizing and the judging that I was feeling coming from her, that I didn't feel safe having her with me at the interview if she was going to be like that. that I was happy to have her there if she was able to be loving and supportive. I shared with her that I was nervous and I was vulnerable and I needed support. So she said she wanted to come. And I said, great. So the morning came when it was for my interview. And I said that she probably needed to wake up early to get herself ready. Well, it was 8 o'clock. She was still asleep. And I was needed to leave in like a half an hour. And there was a thought that came over that's like, oh, this is awesome. You know, she's still asleep. You snooze, you lose. I'm just going to get out of here. And then I get to go by myself and not have to deal. But I paused. I paused because I recognized that I was trying to run that show. I was trying to get it to be my way, you know, to not have her come, to not have to deal with any kind of teenage wackoness on this very important, very, very nerve-wracking day for me. So I paused long enough to seek what God's will is in that moment. And I went into her room, sat on the edge of her bed, put my hand on her hip, and gently, you know, woke her up a little bit. And I said, you know, it's 8 o'clock and I have to leave in a half an hour. Do you want to sleep or would you like to get ready and come with me? And she said she wanted to sleep. And I said, okay. And I closed the door. I walked out of the room, finished getting ready. And then 15 minutes later, she's like, Mom, can I still come? Can I still come? And I'm like, sure, you can come. You know, I'll meet you in the car. And she came and she helped me in the interview. She helped me carry all my paintings into the studio. And she took pictures and videos and she got to be supportive and to see her mom do something really hard. And I got to be the mom who had a kid who was showing up for me and being supportive and being loving. Like, that opportunity never would have happened had I been running the show. But I had released my grip. You know, I am no longer the actor who wants to run this whole show. I know that when I try to run the show, it doesn't come off well. I've experienced that. But you know what? This is God's show. This isn't my show. And I'm always really curious, like, how's this show supposed to turn out? And this is a literal, you know, show, a literal TV interview that I'm like, you know, I'm not running this show. And it's beautiful to release our grip on this show called life, releasing our grip on life. You know, I'm able to let go and have a lot more fun in my life today, releasing my grip on thinking things that like aren't even true. You know, sometimes I have a thought, like when I got back from vacation, I was away from my husband for 4 weeks and the kids and I got back from vacation and I went into the house and, you know, we're kind of loud and messy. And my thinking was, you know, oh my God, you know, we're disrupting his peace. You know, he's happier without us. You know, he's going to want a divorce. I mean, this is where my brain goes, right? This is my crazy disease brain. Still to this day, I have crazy thoughts that completely aren't true. But I've paused so many times in my life in my prayer and meditation practice where I know that that's crazy making. I did not act on any of those thoughts that I had about thinking that, you know, we were just a nuisance to him. And the next day, you know, I did the 10th step. I used my journaling. I called my sponsor. We talked about it. I definitely processed it. But the next day when he and I were in a meditation group, we were all sharing. And he's sharing to the group how grateful he is that we're home. And I'm like, he's grateful that we're home? I thought we were just like, you know, just making his life miserable. And you know, the next morning he's making pancakes and bacon for the kids. And then he comes home with a bouquet of flowers for me in my favorite colors. I am so glad I didn't act on any of that crazy disease thinking that, you know, oh, he's going to want to divorce me because, you know, we're just disturbing his peace. This is how living a 12-step way of life actually works. We pause long enough to release our grip on this crazy, you know, dishonest thinking that we have. identify the lies that the disease is telling us and start focusing on what is the truth. The truth is I have a loving husband who appreciates us and is grateful for us. He doesn't want a divorce. That was just a lie. So there's so many times that my thinking might hijack me. But for me to pause and to relax, to use all the tools of the program, to do my 10 steps, to talk to my sponsors, this is how this Design for Living really works, because I'm actually working it. I'm actually practicing the program. It's a daily practice, and it's about keeping spiritually fit so that when a crazy thought comes in that might be like, oh, a little bit of extra food might help this. No. I can quickly see that that's a lie. Food is not the solution. God is the solution. This is a spiritual solution. And if we just pause long enough and allow ourselves to release our grip, to release our hands and soften our bodies, to breathe, to release our grip on the food, to release our grip on our character defects, to release our grip about our future, our kids, our life, our marriages, and to really allow God to carry us throughout the day. This is a life that should not be missed. It is so beautiful, and it is so effective, this way of life. I really appreciate all of you listening. I hope something that I shared today was helpful to someone else. And I bless you on your journey of recovery. Thank you for letting me be of service, and I pass.
Oh, Chris, thank you so much for this beautiful, compelling, and profound presentation you offered us this morning. Thank you so very much. Today's share ID, 23,711. That's 23711. Chris's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so do stay tuned for that. And we will now transition to a question and answer segment. You can pose a question to Chris by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Mary S., New Mexico.
Rivka R.
Mary S., Rivka R.
Kanayeta.
Kanayeta.
Pedro B.
Pedro B.
Devora B.
Devora B. Okay, let's stop there. Okay, a reminder, questions only, please, in the interest of time. One question per customer. Let's start with Mary S. Go ahead, Mary. Mary S., star 1 to unmute.
Okay, got it. Sorry. Good morning. Thank you so much, Chris and all. My question is about, you know, as breaking down the walls of the perfection with those in my family of origin. My question, I recently did step 9, a major step 9, with a sister super enmeshed with, the scaredest one to do. But it revealed to me I have more step 9 work with my remaining 5 siblings. And they, as number 6 down the line of the child with so much chaos, I had to be so perfect. The more shame and fear I had and disease progression, the more perfectionist I got. So anyway, my question is, did you kind of have a process, or was it a gradual thing with people like family of origin as you broke down your walls of perfection, or did you just spill it all out with a step 9, or how did that go? Does that make sense?
Chris, you'll need to press star 1 to unmute, please.
Thank you, Mary S. For me, letting go of my perfectionism has been a process, and it's ongoing. It's especially with, you talked about your family of origin. For me, especially around my mom, I was always trying to be perfect for her, to not be a problem for her. And gradually in my recovery, I've been able to let her see me as I am. I did a 9-step amends with her where I admitted I was a compulsive overeater to her. I know that that's not what she wanted to hear, but I knew that I had to be honest with her. I needed to make amends with her for some of the things that I did. And it's been slow, but I feel like I can be more authentic with her now, and that I don't have to show up perfectly. You know, my kids are, you know, wacky, and sometimes I even want, like, when I'm with her, I want my kids to be perfect around her, you know? And I've had to really let go of that. Like, sometimes my kids are awful around their grandma. And it's like, you know what? It is what it is. I mean, I have to soften and let go of that, that dishonest thinking that we can only be loved if we show up perfectly. I can actually believe more in best case scenario. The best case scenario is we show up and we got, you know, everything's all hanging out and we're kind of messy, and sometimes our behavior is not on point and sometimes our behavior is absolutely awful. But can we all still love each other within all of that? And, you know, I've noticed too, my mom is 83 and sometimes her behavior is just really, really off. And sometimes she's kind of like that doormat with spikes, you know, where it's she's kind of prickly. And I've had to really let go of demanding perfectionism from her. You know, I always wanted her to be the perfect mom. She was always striving to be. But, you know, she's kind of losing her filters these days. And I find that the more I let go of demanding other people to be perfect, the more I allow myself to be more authentic. And when everybody starts acting more authentically, it's just so much more fun. You know, we start not taking ourselves so seriously. We start joking around more. You know, if I'm aligned with my higher power and I'm being more gentle with myself and forgiving with all my mistakes and allowing myself to kind of like unravel a little bit and kind of like, you know, let things kind of hang out a little bit with the people in my life, I'm so much more approachable and more fun and more easeful to be around. And that has improved with my mom a lot, to the point now where we can kind of joke around and have fun, and, you know, we can love each other in our imperfection. So for me, it's kind of an ongoing process. It wasn't a one and done thing. I don't think our character defects ever really let go of us completely all at once in some lightning bolt streak. Maybe that has happened for someone, but that's not my experience. It's a little bit more the educational variety where we release and let go and a little bit of our character defect slips away, and then we release and let go a little more and more of the defect gets removed by God. And gradually over a long period of time, you know, we really do have transformation, like a psychic change where we are really different. But it does take time. So we have to be content with patient improvement and not demand perfectionism from ourselves or other people, but just notice the wins, notice the small wins. That's a really great thing when you do your gratitude and your 10th step every night. What are some of the wins? You know, you were a little more patient with someone. You know, you let your house be messy for a few extra days than you would normally tolerate, you know? That kind of stuff. Like, the small wins.
Thank you, Mary S., for your question. Rivka R., your turn.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much, Leah. Oh, Chris, it was so wonderful. I related to so much, and I was crying, literally crying by the end of your talk. So thank you. So my question is, when you said my food isn't perfect, but it's aligned with God, I just want to know, how do you determine that it's God's will and that your self-will isn't like sneaking in there?
Can I be heard?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay. I just want to make sure I didn't have to press star one again. Yeah, my food isn't perfect, but it's aligned with God. What I mean by that is that my food is neutral, that my amounts are moderate, and that I'm not about perfectionism and control as it is so much in allowing a connection with my higher power, which is love, to guide me in my food choices, in neutral food choices that aren't loud. You know, if food has a lot of noise to it, I pay attention to that. If I'm kind of feeling like I really, really, really want something, I pay attention to that, because I don't really want to be in that state of, you know, wanting, you know, having to have, oh, I have to have this, I have to have that. It's nice to mix things up a little bit. Usually I have the same breakfast every morning just because it's easy, but I don't have to have that. If I have to completely shift it up and change out, you know, my protein and my starch, and like, yeah, it's fine, like I can do that. But no matter what, you know, I've been placed in a position of neutrality with food. That means I've really released all of the foods that I know of that were not neutral, you know, that were like the yellow and the red light foods, as they say. I stick to pretty much my green list because it's quiet. Yeah, and you know how much I love the quiet. My food needs to be quiet. If it's an event, I need to pay attention to it. If I'm, you know, scheming and trying to, you know, make it all exciting, I need to kind of look at that. Like, what's really going on there? So I would say that allowing God to help you find neutrality with food is really what it's about. It's not about being perfect, because, you know, abstinence and food plan are different. A food plan is a tool of the program. Abstinence is our purpose. Abstaining is our purpose in OA. Our purpose is to abstain from compulsive overeating and compulsive food behaviors, you know. And in order to do that, we need neutrality with food. And, you know, what's neutral for me is not neutral for other people. And I remember one time my sponsor was eating something. We were having dinner together, and she was eating something, and my eyes were like golf balls. I'm like, you can eat that? And she's like, yeah, that doesn't bother me. I'm going, oh, my God, I just used to binge on that. So no one can tell you what it's going to be like for you to be neutral with food. That's only through your own experience of being convinced by your own experience on what you can and cannot safely eat. What foods are peaceful and what are not? What foods are loud? What foods are quiet? So I would do a deep dive into food, what food sobriety looks like for you, and really allow God in to show you the truth. Because ultimately, we are willing to release. We have to be willing to release the foods that are not neutral, but we're not the ones who take it away. We're not controlling it. We're allowing for the foods to be removed that are no longer serving us. And miraculously, the food lets go of us. And that's really neutrality. So that's all I have to say on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Rivka R. Hanayeta, your question, please. Hanayeta?
Yes, hi. Sorry, I disconnected my phone. I had to call back in.
Sure. Your question,
this is Hanayeta.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Leah, for your service. And Chris, wow, I just cannot even tell you. I think I'm still in tears. What a powerful share. So you said many times that was a lie. I heard that, but it was a lie. Have you ever thought that those lies are your disease talking to you and telling you those lies? And the other, these are quick. I would love to know how many kids you have and what kind of art you do.
Well, 100% the lies are the disease. I mean, when I have a thought that is not true, that usually it has an origin in a very old place. Like for me to think that, you know, we're a nuisance and, you know, my husband doesn't want us around anymore, you know, we're disturbing his peace, he's going to want a divorce. I mean, that's my all or nothing thinking. That is totally the disease mind. That is me going, spinning off into worst case scenario, doom and gloom, super negative self-talk. This still happens to me to this day, where I will spin out on, just the other day I was doing, you know, an art, I'm an oil painter, I do plein air and still life paintings. I started out really realistically, and now, as you can imagine, my work is really loosening up and I'm getting more fun, and I'm painting peonies with like more of an impressionistic style, because my perfectionism, I'm letting go of my perfectionism in my art now too, which is great. Instead of being so tightly controlled, I'm just letting go and I'm having more fun. And I took this cloud painting workshop the other day. And, you know, I'm in Alabama now, right? There's these gorgeous clouds and they're beautiful and they're billowy. And you know, I'm from LA. I don't have any experience painting clouds. I mean, I lived in smog for 50 years. So I can't really paint clouds very well. So I was in this workshop with this master painter trying to paint clouds. And the thoughts that were coming to me was like, you can't paint. You don't know what you're doing. You suck. You know, here I am going to have an art show, you know, coming up this week, and I was on TV, and I'm in this workshop thinking that I'm a piece of shit painter, that I can't paint, that I'm no good. I mean, look at the crazy brain there, right? I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, it really threw me. I was going down. I was spiraling. I told my husband about it, and he's like, man, you're really in a bad place. I go, I know, man, the disease thinking. It's like, you know, I'm powerless over my thinking sometimes. These thoughts come at me, and I don't know where they're coming from. I don't know why I would have this thought that, you know, I'm no good, because I've been painting for 30 years. I mean, the truth, is that I'm a painter and that I'm working, I make a living as an artist, I'm fine. That's the truth. The disease wants me dead. That I know. The disease tells me lies. I can't, please, we have got to not believe everything we think. Our thinking cannot be trusted. You know, that's why it says, you know, we have an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. Our mind, oh my gosh, that's really where, like, once we get to the point where we're eating, you know, food neutral, then we really get to see how crazy we are in our head. And if you have enough mindfulness and practice, pausing and not reacting, but taking time to pause so that you can respond, right? That's that sweet spot in recovery where we don't act on everything that we think, and we don't speak everything that we think. Oh my God, God forbid, you know. Practice being quiet and just listening is huge, even if it's to your own thinking. Just listen. And in a 10th step at night, really look at it. Like, what are the thoughts that I'm having, and are these even true? That's the dishonesty. When I go through my 10th step at night and I look at my selfishness, my dishonesty, my resentment, my fear, what were my dishonest thoughts today? That I'm a shitty painter and I can't paint? No, that's not true. What would infinite love have to say to that? Infinite love says, Chris, your painting is a gift to the universe. Please don't judge it. Please just keep painting keep enjoying the gift of painting and allow other people to experience your paintings as they are. And trust me and be gentle with yourself. And so then I align with the words of God in my mind versus the words of the disease in my mind. I've got to get to a point where that turns around. Because I have to live in alignment with God, not in alignment with the disease. And if I stay too much in that disease thought, they happen. But I'm aware and I'm awake and I pull the covers on them. I expose them. I talk about them. I identify them. I talk to my sponsor. I do a 10-step train where I read my 10th step out loud to someone every single day. And I let it out. And then it doesn't have such a grip on me. So with that, I'll pass on that one. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Chris, for all that you gave us today in your presentation. Again, the share ID for today, 23,711. Thank you, Chris, for such an inspiring, beautiful presentation this morning. We're going to close now from page 164, found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is so sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.